Hello.
Hi.
I don't really know where to look when we're together anymore. I think I look at you on the screen.
It's a bit weird, isn't it? Also, I'm so much bigger than you.
I know, but you're on the tiny seat as well, which is very
Yeah, because I'm
strange.
much closer. Anyway, we're together today, which is very nice. We've just been doing lots of EIQ work.
Yeah, some of it you'll hear about extremely soon if you are an EIQ student, EIQ grad, or previous EIQ. Grad too, actually. You'll be hearing from us. I'm sure
Yes,
you're waiting on
sure.
tenderhooks already.
Absolutely fine, Harriet. I'm glad that you could join us. Okay. Well, we're not going to tease anything else, are we? No.
No, just honestly, just watch your phones. Watch your phones, watch your emails, watch your Facebook group. Just watch and wait. It's going to be great.
I'm very excited for it.
Yes.
Okay.
Should we just get started on the questions?
Let's do it.
Oops. No, Facebook. You have random people that you don't have. It's like you wouldn't follow necessarily on Instagram, say, but they've been on your Facebook friends list forever. I just opened my Facebook and it was just on the stories part and it was a girl's butt. I don't
Oh,
even know if I know whose
no.
butt it was. I immediately took came off it. Probably from my computer days. Okay. Sorry. Okay, Danielle's question. Hello. Have completed the first lecture and have a question. 60% of basal metabolic rate comes from liver, brain, heart, and kidneys. So if you're going through phases of those organs working harder, would it increase the basal metabolic rate to any noticeable significance? For example, brain revision, stress, liver, high consumption of alcohol, etc. And should we increase calorie consumption in those times to help the body function?
Well, you looked this up, didn't you?
I did. What I would say is like what you're going to find as you go through EIQ is that there's going to be little bits that you find really interesting and you dig deep, and like we very much welcome you digging deeper into this stuff and like us getting to talk about it. And just always, I think, be mindful of one, what you are interested in, two, like what your clients need to know, and three, like maybe what you share if your social media is about business stuff. A lot of time people learn all the like the deeper things and then start sharing that, talking about that on social media and things. And actually, a lot of the time that's not necessarily the most useful stuff for people to hear, even though you buzz off it. This is like a kind of good example of that, of like, love that you've asked this question and like that you're intrigued by that. And rather, love that you've asked it, and it's something that you will never ever have to consider, probably ever again. When the question came up, I was like, know what basal metabolic rate is for 20 years, but it's never that, it's not a thought that maybe I had it 20 years ago, but once, like, it's not something that comes up.
Yeah, it's not like, I mean, if you look at your total daily energy expenditure, so the calories you burn in a day, and you look at what you can and can't control. So, like, of course, like basal metabolic rate for most people is the largest percentage of that, unless you're extremely active. But that's not really something that you can control very much. And I think the problem, not this is just using this as an example, this is actually just quite a funny, interesting question. But the problem with when people are like, I don't know, your basal metabolic rate will reduce during this stage of your menstrual cycle or increase during this stage of your menstrual cycle, or it your basal metabolic rate reduces if you lose a lot of weight and stuff. People never ask by how much. That's what gets me though. I'm like, it's like, oh yeah, well, you're just gonna ruin your metabolism. And the reason that you can't completely dispute that is like, yes, you are correct. Your metabolism might reduce by a very small amount, probably like 80 to 100 calories a day. If you lose a significant amount of weight and you don't increase your activity levels and all other things being equal. And it's same with like people hear something like this and they're like, oh well, you know, like if you think more, then you'll burn more calories. It's like, technically you are right, but you really need to like think about the magnitude of effects. Like, okay, well, how many more calories?
And so the numbers that I was looking at was like if someone did something really sensory intensive, so they were learning a new instrument, potentially for 8 full hours without dwindling, without losing concentration, without slowing down because you were getting burns in their fingers, none of that. It was like a maximum of 100 calories. But if you are someone who tends to go for a walk 3 times a day and you just sat that off to do your 800 calorie, your 8 hours, sorry, of playing an instrument, then, or learning a new instrument, then it completely mitigates it. So I think like
that's a good point as well, because you think actually if you want to concentrate really hard, you can't really do anything else. And almost anything else will burn more calories than concentrating really hard.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why we don't
I would
do
say
it.
The only, not really caveat, but just different situation. I'm like, oh, when does basal metabolic rate kind of come into play is if it like burns victims,
Yeah.
Their basal metabolic rate does increase. Now, normally they're not moving around. So again, still, but like there is more need to get in calories in certain situations. Because when you asked here, that just made me think when you asked here, like, oh, do you need to be eating more if you're, I don't know, doing exams or something? It's like, no, that like,
don't tell my mum that. She always used to make us waffles, beans and eggs on exam days, and it was absolutely, it's the best thing for exam days. The thing is too, like, should we increase calorie consumption in those times to help the body function? Our bodies are incredible at fuel utilization, at knowing what they need to do when, on the whole, right? Especially when our bodies are health in a healthy state. So if you didn't have enough energy for that 8 hours of learning a new instrument, then your body could metabolize that energy from its energy stores or from the food that you've got, because likelihood is it's not going to be many calories anyway. It's definitely not a case of just like, this is input and this is output, as much as like that's ultimately the energy balance equation. There's so much stuff going in, like,
yeah,
going around.
And your brain's glucose supply is like one of the most well-preserved things in the human body, like that's why you don't fall into a coma when you go to sleep and things. I was actually having this, not quite this discussion, but a similar discussion with my mum when we were away, because she was like, fasting came up at the table, and like, is it, I know it's coming up with the next question as well, but like, is it a good thing or a bad thing? And then like the kind of common narrative is like, well, you know, if you're going to go out for a big walk or do some exercise, you should eat something before. And when you kind of whittle it down, you think, well, actually, from like an evolutionary standpoint, because I think I said something quite abrupt, like, how, what did I say? Like, I think I said something like, how weak do you think the human body is, mum? And she was like, what do you mean? And I was like, well, you know, like, do you think we really evolved over thousands of years to need food right before we go for like a little walk in the morning? Like, of course not. Like, people, like, the version of us that would have needed that would have died off years and years and years and years ago, right? Like, most, if you take the last, like, I don't know, 500 odd years away, you probably would have done most of your movement right before you ate in a fasted state. Like, okay, well, now we need to find food. Now we need to forage for food or something. You won't have eaten. It's not like, oh, now we need to forage for food. Better take this electrolyte and have some pre-workout and have a little meal beforehand. Like, we're absolutely fine to exercise fasted.
With some exceptions, obviously.
Not if you have hypothermia.
Yeah. Or pregnant in general.
But again, like, there's probably a lot of, I mean, not that I am suggesting this by any stretch, but
Emma Story Gordon says all pregnant people should train fasted.
Yeah. But like, would you be fine? 100%. Like, a pregnant person training fasted, like, you would 100% be fine.
Next question. Okay, next question. This is a EIQ question. So Melly's question. What a nice name.
What
is that her name? Melly. M-E-L-L-Y.
You said Smelly.
It's a Smelly question. It's a lovely name.
Melly's a lovely name.
Yeah, it is a lovely name. Okay. Someone asked me if this was a level 3 or 4. I didn't sign up for the level. I signed up because I love what you both stand for and to expand my knowledge. And then heart. How do you do a heart with your hands? Yeah, that, because you're a millennial. So do I. So people that are listening don't know that Emma just basically blew a big bunch of love hearts on me on Zoom. Yeah, apparently Gen Z do it in a different way, like with their fingers. I don't know how to do it.
No
way. It's not sure. Anyway, currently it's not an off-qual level, in terms of the EIQ nutrition course. So that is why you didn't know if it was a level three or a level four. After the course, could you technically call yourself a nutritionist or nutrition coach? Yes. We generally recommend like EIQ certified nutritionist.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And blessing to have you. Okay, Marietta's question, another beautiful name. Hi ladies, long post. I'm curious about the benefits of fasting beyond calorie deficit and just eating less. There was a story on the news here in Spain about chrononutrition, referencing some recent research that found that there are health benefits to eating in line with circadian rhythms. The study found skipping breakfast or eating it late and eating dinner after 8 p.m. was associated with greater cardiovascular risk of things like strokes and PIAs. I've seen a lot of social media content recently that was saying fasting benefits are just about eating less, and the benefits are that fasting models like intermittent fasting or time-restricted feeding are basically nice frameworks to help you do the fasting. But actually, it seems timing does matter. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this and the benefits of fasting. I'm also thinking, I wonder what this means for Spain, as 9 p.m. is a later time to eat dinner, even 10 p.m. or later. And then she linked the study.
Yeah, I think it is interesting. I think there is strong enough research now to show that fasting independently of, well, like calorie-matched fasting protocols, so when you eat, not just how much you eat, does play an impact. Now, I would say more specifically for people who are already at high risk of like hypertension. So I think where people get a little bit confused about like the body of research as a whole is if you do it in even overweight but not hypertensive or diabetic patients or population, what you tend to find is you don't really see that much benefit over and above weight loss. But when you do it in a population that is at high risk of metabolic complications, then there is some strong research now, well, from my opinion, strong research now that shows that there is some kind of benefit, not just to how much you eat, but when you eat as well.
Yeah, so I don't know if you've done lecture two. There's a slide in lecture two where I do talk about, I think it's lecture two. Actually, do you know where it is? It's not lecture two, so you've not done this yet. In bundle two, in the lecture around dieting, I do have a slide on there that talks about the difference between fasting and time-restricted feeding and the potential health benefits of time-restricted feeding. Because yes, like there are. And I think if you take the body of research and you look at, let's take kind of remove resistance training people, exercising people, athletes out of this equation at the moment, right? And you were to say, okay, metabolically, if you were to optimize what they do nutrition-wise, what would you do? And from the body of research, I would say probably front load more of your relatively more calories, because you see at night, like according to your circadian rhythm, right? So I don't think it'll matter in terms of like the hour that you eat, like being an hour ahead and stuff like that, because I feel like a lot of this is to do with like light dark cycles and stuff as well. And that's obviously going to be shifted in a different country. But at night you see like reduced gastric emptying, you see reductions in glucose, that's what I'm looking for.
Insulin sensitivity,
beta cell function changes, there's changes in diet induced thermogenesis, all like for the quote worse at night. So metabolically it makes sense that you would front load more of your calories, and then when you do that, you also see things like potential changes in ghrelin levels. So hunger regulation might be slightly better when you eat more in the morning. And although like when calories are matched, it makes no difference. When calories are not matched, there are some pieces of research that like associate greater fat loss with earlier intake of food versus later. And there's obviously could be loads of reasons for that when it's not like matched calorie controlled. But yeah, I think like on a very, very like on a very individual personal level, I front load my calories where possible. I don't change my diet massively, like socially and stuff, that's hard. But on the whole, because I also exercise in the morning, so because I'm not moving as much at night, I don't have that improved insulin sensitivity from training, so it makes more sense for me to front load things. I also get very hungry, so again, but it's not about saying all people should eat like that. And it's about saying it's very different from fasting, just like thinking that there's benefits of just eating at a specific window. If you look at people who fast, listening to like, you know, Diary of a CEO, and they go and fast, I guarantee you they fast from, they have an eating window from like 12 to 8. So it's like it's
And also, like when you look at the technical, if you look in the research, like technically fasting is meant to be like 5-2 protocols or like 12 hours plus of not consuming, whereas time restricted eating or feeding, if they're looking at animal research, is more to do with these like 12-8, or you know, like you're basically moving your breakfast further back and then your dinner further forward. And I think it probably does, you know, like does make a bit of sense to have a smaller eating window, have more like more time for not constantly snacking and grazing on things. I think that would, like, I can't see why it wouldn't help your metabolism to an extent, or your metabolic health to an extent. I don't think it will make any difference if you're someone who's lean, fit and active, which is funny because obviously those are the people that are most likely to fast, right? It's like, oh, like, you know, the mega health aware that are already doing all the right things, and this is gonna literally make, you know, it's like giving £10 to a millionaire, like it's probably going to make absolutely no difference to them, but they're more likely to do it. When you sort of asked about in Spain, people like eating really late at night, again, you have to look at like magnitude of effects, because there are a lot of places around like the Med that are blue zones, right? And they all eat much later at night and they drink coffee late at night. You know, they do a lot of things that, like, you know, all they have for breakfast is like an espresso, and then they have bigger meals later at night. But yet, probably because they're so active and they're not overweight, like it's not making a big difference. So you kind of have to think, like, is that important to me? What benefits am I going to get from it? And then I think sometimes, I think one of the real benefits here is if you are someone who's overweight and diabetic or something, and you can really benefit from this, you still, the biggest benefit is going to come from the fat loss that's going to come alongside this. But if you buy into the narrative of, and there is science to prove it, of, you know, I should eat less in the morning, less in the evening, more in the morning, I should time this, that there's reasons behind doing it, you're way more likely to stick to it. Like the most adherence I ever had on a diet was carb backloading, because I thought there was some kind of like benefit to doing it. I think one of the things that's like an issue with flexible dieting is it's too flexible. Oh, it doesn't really matter, it's just calories. All right, well then, doesn't matter if I eat this now or then or whatever. Like, there's too little rules in some ways, and that's why people struggle to stick to it. So you kind of have to have this like happy medium. And if you're trying to do that in an ethical way, as in not just like don't eat after 6 p.m., but if you're like, hey, there's research to show blah 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 blah, and you can kind of give them like a bit of a framework behind it and rationale behind it, you're probably going to get better buy-in, better adherence. And we know that actually at the end of the day, adherence is the most important thing. So if you can do that with this information, great. Do I think it's night and day? And if someone's like, well, I work shifts, what are you going to say? Quit your job because you need to be intermittent fasting, or it needs to be like this. I think it's hard with shift work people because they are at a disadvantage. But if you're thinking practically as well, one of the things that I was reading something recently, and it was, I didn't actually get to the end of it, but it was quite interesting. It was like figuring out what the benefits between actually just having consistent meals at the same time versus like specific timings of those meals. Mm-hmm. So like, does it matter if you open your fast between 7 and this time, or like 10 and this time, or whatever? Or is it more that you're eating at the same time, which comes into the chrononutrition of like, if you're just consistently waking up at the same time, eating at the same time, your body knows what's going on. It's not getting like dysregulated by, why are we eating now? Why are we awake now? And by the way, short term, that doesn't make a difference. If you're like, oh my God, but I'm going to America for a week on holiday, like, doesn't make a difference. If you're moving all over the world all the time, it probably does start to make a bit of difference. And if you've got the ability, which most of us do, to set up our days of like, well, I will have lunch between 12 and half 12. And I will have my first meal between 8 and 8:30, or, you know, whatever. And don't become over obsessed with it, but actually having some consistency, and then your hunger levels start to respond to that as well, probably going to help adherence too.
Mm. I think there's some cool research too that, again, you will come to on the PCOS lecture. So that's in the last bundle, where they looked at like front loading versus late loading calories for people with PCOS, and they were obese type PCOS, and there were like improvements again in insulin sensitivity and even in, I want to say, in hyperandrogenism as well. It was really, really interesting. But even if like you touched on shift workers, even like with shift workers, well, you know, I had this conversation with a client the other day, because it, not because she was stressing about her metabolic health, but just in terms of what to eat, because it's obviously a hard time, everyone's exhausted and they're more likely to snack. But even if like you can look at food choices of like, okay, I'm going to focus predominantly on protein and fat sources when I'm working overnight, still eat enough, like pack out your meals, fiber, etc., but fewer carbohydrates where possible. Even that alone, if you're working shift work for your entire life, that would be something that I would look at. Again, it's not like saying you should quit your job, it's really unhealthy. It's more just, okay, well, how can we support this shift in your metabolic flexibility, or yeah, your metabolism overnight? Let's just kind of shift how you eat at those times. You can still eat regularly, can still eat, but you should maybe shift your food choices.
I also think really the eating more in the morning and then less at night, I think that often helps because most people overeat at night. But one of the reasons that they're overeating at night is normally because they've not eaten enough during the day, right? And then you get to this point where you are really hungry, you are really tired, you do have decision fatigue, and then you end up overeating. So I think there might be an element of that as well, that people find it easier to stick to their diets, even though initially they'd be like, oh no, I can never do that, I always have my biggest meal in the evening. And it's like, maybe one of the reasons you have your biggest meal in the evening is because you don't eat enough during the day.
Okay, Devin's question. Any good references or advice to give pros and cons for non-obese clients wanting to take semaglutide? How do you say it? I say
semaglutide. Is that right?
I don't know. I always say it differently every time I say it.
And then same with, I always say Ozempic, but it's Ozempic.
Yeah. Okay, there we go. So however we say it, semaglutides, whatever. Like Ozempic for strictly weight loss. I have many clients that their doctors are pushing it. If I could be more knowledgeable, then I could provide some better points. Their doctors don't seem to be giving any feedback. No doctor would be pushing Ozempic if their BMI is normal. No, like it's...
I don't believe that.
No,
yeah.
I agree. There's like the Ozempic like recommendations are that they are prescribed to people who are, I don't know what the BMI cutoff is. I think it's obese, but potentially overweight and obese, potentially.
But also there's a shortage as well, like even for diabetics. So I just can't believe that they'd be... Yeah. Now, what I can believe is that your clients want to take it because they think that it's going to be an easier way to lose weight. And if I'm completely transparent, probably will be.
Yeah.
And then you've just got to think the pros and cons for that person.
Yeah.
And that's what you need to kind of... I mean, the grads will already have a lecture on this. But really, those pros and cons are dependent on the severity of your obesity and the side effects that you're having from that. And you know, like for a diabetic, it's normally worth it, right? And there are side effects to taking a drug. There's not that many long-term studies on it. Again, like I don't want to sound like I'm pushing it, because I'm certainly not, but the side effects probably aren't as bad as what a lot of people, you know, like some people will have gastrointestinal distress, that's probably like the most common and usually the most severe side effect, and then it seems to wear off after a couple of weeks once you kind of get used to it. I also think that's probably one of the reasons it works, is because it's uncomfortable to eat. You feel quite sick and uncomfortable, so you're probably going to eat less. But yeah, it is like it should be a discussion between them and their doctor. I think maybe encouraging people that you, if you think someone can do it without it, it's always going to be a better thing to do. But it's a pretty potent appetite suppressant.
Yeah. And I think there's like this kind of pushback from especially people who have less knowledge about it in the fitness industry, like, yeah, but it doesn't teach you habits, and if you stop taking it, you gain weight again. And it's like, if you stop taking most medications, they stop working. That
stop
is what they do.
Stop taking statins and your blood pressure will go back
up. Exactly. Stop taking the pill and, well, you know what happens. Like, they are supposed to stop working when you stop taking them, but they're working with you. You're a great coach. You support them in their behavior change, their habit development, their nutrition choices, their education, their knowledge, so that when they do stop taking it, they have all of these things in place too, and that will help them maintain the weight.
It's also not one or the other. Like, yeah. You know, no matter what, if you want to be fit and healthy, you even if you're taking an appetite suppressant, you still need to look at what you're eating. Like, maybe even when you're eating it to maintain your health, as we just spoke about. You need to look at your exercise programming, you know, like, how are you getting things? Like, what's your injury risk? What training do you want to do? Are you building muscle? Is your nutrition supporting building muscle? How's your sleep? You know, all the stuff that we do as coaches, like, it's not just, if we only coach people on hunger levels, then I'd be like, oh, yeah, well, we might be out of the job here. But, like, it doesn't, like, I work with quite a few people that have tried it or are still on it. It doesn't really change everything else that they have to do.
Me too. There's also some very small initial evidence in regards to people with binge eating disorder and these drugs too. I think that there was initially, like, this, again, this pushback of, like, yeah, but it doesn't, quote, unquote, cure an eating disorder. And it's like, yeah, but also most people with binge eating disorder are in larger bodies. You know, the risk of things like type 2 diabetes is greater in people with binge eating disorders. So it's like, okay, again, I'm not saying go and take Ozempic if you have binge eating disorder. Definitely, I'm not saying that. But it is interesting, some of the research that's coming out around this. And you know, we on the team, again, I personally don't work with people with eating disorders, but Rosalind does. And, you know, we have shared clients who on the team who do take Ozempic through their doctor.
And I could see that working really well, because one of the big problems, especially if someone's been binging for a long time, is they just don't believe that they ever couldn't. So even if they could take a drug for a period of time that showed them what their life would be like if they didn't do that, and that they could not do that. And yeah, I think from, like, a psychological perspective and a habit forming perspective as well. And then also you might kind of see, okay, is the binge more psychological or physiological hunger? Because if you're removing the physiological hunger and people are still binging, which, by the way, also happens with weight loss surgery, and then people kind of eat back out of their gastric band kind of thing. That's quite interesting as well.
Mm. Okay, I think that's the last question.
Freaking great questions today.
Fantastic questions.
Very much enjoyed those.
Lovely variety.
We just got a compliment here. Golden, multi-layered practical info. Thank you.
We are golden and multi-layered.
And we're also, where are we going for dinner?
Going to Fava. We're going for Greek food. Anyway, I've already looked at the menu. I'm getting gyros.
Is it gyros or gyro?
I don't know, but it's delicious. It's flatbread and halloumi.
Oh, right, okay.
And fries and vegetables.